Hello, and welcome to the new episode of Memcast. This is Tom from Northampton General Hospital, and this week we've got an episode on ANCA-positive vasculitis. We're very lucky to be joined this time by Dr. Harris Fayaz, who is an ST5 in Northampton General Hospital and is showing me the ropes of rheumatology at the minute. How are you doing, Harris?
Thank you very much, Tom, for the nice introduction. Very happy to be on this podcast, and I'm sure you don't necessarily need me to show the ropes. You're already quite smart in that regard.
I'm getting there. So with this episode, we want to look at, we're going to look a little bit about etiology of ANCA-positive vasculitis, talk a bit about the pathophysiology, just to get a bit of background. Then we'll look at the presentation itself, all the various systems that can be involved, and sort of related to that, talk about the differential diagnosis, how we approach the patient, and how we home in on our diagnosis of ANCA-positive vasculitis. We're going to look at investigations after that, how we might target those investigations based on our assessment of the patient, and then talk about the treatment of the ANCA-positive vasculitis, looking at sort of the initial treatment and the maintenance after that. So without further ado, would you be able to tell us a little bit, Harris, about what ANCA-positive vasculitis actually is, how common it is, and how it affects us?
Yes, Tom, thank you very much. So ANCA-associated vasculitis primarily categorized as a small vessel vasculitis. For the purpose of this talk, I will primarily focus on GPA. Historically, GPA and MPA have been categorized as separate entities, but now we are realizing that it's more of an overlap between the two. Granulomatosis polyangiitis and microscopic polyangiitis. Apart from these two, the other ANCA-associated vasculitis is EGPA. So we'll talk briefly about that as well. So microscopic polyangiitis is primarily associated with necrotizing vasculitis that primarily affects capillaries, venules, arterioles, and it manifests as necrotizing glomerular nephritis or pulmonary capillaries. Granulomatous inflammation is usually absent in MPA, and ANCA is primarily positive in more than 90% of the patients. While, as I said, the MPA and GPA, it continues to be regarded as distinct entities within AAV, but there is markedly overlapping manifestations, and sometimes it can be difficult to differentiate between these two diseases within a patient. EGPA, as I briefly said, so it's eosinophilic-rich necrotizing vasculitis, predominantly affecting small to medium-sized vessels. Patients often can have chronic rhinosinusitis, asthma, prominent peripheral blood eosinophilia. ANCA is present in these patients as well, usually around 40% of the patients. And it's usually anti-MPO ANCA. And usually ANCA is more frequent in patients who have underlying glomerular nephritis. Now, the etiology of this disease, it's generally poorly understood. There have been, or there can be, association with other autoimmune diseases. Genetic factors may have a role. Silica or heavy metal exposure or other chemicals have also been proposed as a potential environmental trigger, but those links still have to be definitely proven. And minority of the patients who have ANCA-associated vasculitis, it can be triggered by certain drugs as well, which include hydralazine, propyl thiouracil, minocycline, and combination of cocaine and levimazole. I just want to focus on that. Primarily, cocaine as a drug, it's highly cut using another drug called levimazole. And it is that drug which is the inciting agent for the cocaine-induced vasculitis. Now, moving on to the pathophysiology. We target small to medium vessels, and characterized by necrotizing granulomatous vasculitis with little or no immune deposits. And oftentimes when you do biopsy, kidney biopsy for these patients, it shows post-immune glomerular nephritis, which basically means no immune deposits on immunofluorescence are observed. Moving on towards the role of ANCA. ANCA itself is anti-neutrophilic cytoplasmic antibody. And there are two specific types of ANCA we have observed in these diseases. Number one is antiproteinase 3. And the anti-myeloperoxidase antibodies. And oftentimes what happens is that the primed neutrophils, they express the membrane PR3, and they can be bound by the ANCA, which in turn enhance the neutrophil endothelial interaction, causing the endothelial injury and more adhesions. And start with the whole cascade of complement pathway in turn involving the C5a proteins. At the end, we will talk about the role of certain drugs which are C5a inhibitors in these diseases. Now, primarily the ANCA itself, it's produced by stimulated B cells, which in turn lead to the vasculitis. And some of the treatments that we use for ANCA-associated vasculitis, they have a role how they act on those cells to produce the production of ANCA at the cellular level.
I think it's good we've had a quick run through of that, because actually, like you said, you can call back to that when you're looking at the treatments and say, this is why we know that these types of disease-modifying therapy works and why we use certain types rather than others. So I think, like you said, remembering about the B cells and particularly the complement is useful going forward.
Yeah.
How do these patients present if we're on the take and we start taking a history or looking at these patients? What kind of things are they going to come to, you know, ED with?
The clinical presentation, if you take the clinical presentation in a systematic manner, I think you can easily pick up this disease. But at the same time, it's important to bear in mind that the differential list for patients presenting with these symptoms, it can be wide. Primarily, you will encounter a patient who will give you a history of constitutional symptoms, weight loss, malaise, fatigue, night sweats. These kind of symptoms can be associated with a wide variety of other diseases, infection, malignancy, lymphomas. So other than the constitutional symptoms, these patients can have upper respiratory tract symptoms, lower respiratory tract symptoms, similarly ocular involvement, skin involvement, kidney involvement. So if I talk a bit more detail, they can complain of coughing and hemoptysis from the lower respiratory tract point of view. And from the upper respiratory tract point of view or ENT point of view, they can complain of symptoms from the sinusitis, nasal crusting, epistaxis. And oftentimes, ongoing inflammation in the nasal cartilage can lead to collapsed nasal septum and leading to a saddle nose, which is quite pathognomic of this disease. They have got this depressed nasal bridge. And similarly, one of the complications can be, they can have hoarseness of voice, so due to subglottic stenosis, which is due to the cartilage get involved with the inflammatory process. And kidney involvement, they can have, it's primarily glomerulonephritic picture that you see. Microscopic hematuria is more common. From the cutaneous point of view, these patients can have cutaneous vasculitis with nail fold, infarcts, and purpura. And from the ophthalmologic or orbital involvement point of view, you may notice proptosis due to retroorbital granulomas. And around 50% of the patients can have ocular involvement, including conjunctivitis, scleritis, or uveitis. It's important to know that these patients can also have neurologic involvement, cranial nerve involvement, or symptoms of mononeuritis multiplex in the peripheral nerve branches as well. So in a way, it's affecting quite a lot of symptoms. And to summarize, you can expect skin involvement, eye, sinuses, nose, cartilage and trachea, pulmonary involvement with nodules, and kidney involvement, and nervous system involvement, along with the constitutional symptoms. So if you go through these symptoms in a patient in a systematic manner, you should be able to pick it up that there is some widespread inflammatory condition going on. At the same time, while you're doing it, it's important to bear in mind that the differentials diagnosis as well. Now, if I talk about from the differential diagnosis point of view, the main differentials, GPA or MPA, but as I said, usually there can be an overlap between the two, and it's not always easy to differentiate in a patient.
Right. So, like you said, there's a huge amount of different symptoms that could be involved, and obviously, you said the main two types we're thinking about are GPA and MPA. And whilst they do exist on a sort of spectrum, are there any ways that you might differentiate between the two during your examination? And also, what are the differential diagnoses might you be thinking about?
Yes, Tom, I think that's a really good question. So as you mentioned, that there can be overlap between the two, but still there are a few things which are more characteristic of one than the other. Now, MPA is usually associated with absence of upper respiratory tract features, which we normally see in patients with GPA, sinus involvement or ENT symptoms. So that can be lacking in patients with MPA. And the other differential here could be EGPA. But as we discussed, primarily you will see a high eosinophilic count. If you're not sure, it's always good to involve a specialist and take it from there. In the acute sort of setting, the primary treatment may not differ a lot.
Perfect. Whilst those may be the main sort of diagnoses we're thinking about, what other differentials might we also want to make sure we're sort of including or excluding when we're assessing our patient?
Differentials in patients presenting with these features can vary wide and varied. Some of the important differentials to keep in mind are that, if I talk broadly, is that it's important that you always rule out infection. So appropriate screening from that point of view is important. If they're suffering from any systemic infection, cultures would be appropriate. Secondly, infective endocarditis. Patients with infective endocarditis can have positive antibodies as well. So that's something important to bear in mind. But a good clinical examination, you can notice patients could have murmurs, if they're spiking fevers and other systemic features. And an echo could be a good investigation to rule out that if they've got any cardiac involvement, which could point towards infective endocarditis. So after infection, malignancy is quite important differential. So appropriate investigations, or maybe doing a CT chest abdomen pelvis to rule out that there's no source of cancer anyway, could be a good investigation. And more focused history, which could point you towards thinking from the malignancy point of view and going to any risk factors. Now, if I talk about autoimmune differentials, polyarteritis nodosa could be one, but it's important to note that usually there is absence of upper or lower respiratory tract involvement in these patients. There's no glomerulonephritis on renal biopsy. ANCA testing is negative, and this disease involves the medium vessels more, and there's involvement of or presence of aneurysms or microaneurysms on arteriography. The other important differential to be considered here is anti-GBM disease, which also involves renal and the lungs. But you can test it. The key investigation in that case could be anti-GBM antibody and renal histology. Similarly, lupus can be important differential here, but usually that involves a specific photosensitive rash. There can be complaint of alopecia or symptoms of serositis. The relevant investigation from that point of view, you could do ANA testing, which is quite sensitive, and it similarly complements. And dsDNA. dsDNA is quite specific for lupus, but it's not always positive. The other differentials could include cryoglobulinemia or mixed cryoglobulinemia. It's more commonly associated with hepatitis C in more than 90% of the cases. Then we can talk about sarcoidosis. Usually patients presenting with sarcoidosis can, from the skin point of view, they can have erythema nodosum. They can have ureitis, lymphadenopathy, splenomegaly, and it's associated with non-caseating granulomas and most of the time ANCA will be negative in these patients. The only other thing was, lastly, you could also consider drug-induced vasculitis as well.
So is it good in this case, I guess, to have, when you're assessing these patients, almost a bit of a surgical sieve and make sure you've thought about, if not each specific one, but at least thinking about the various groups of causes, make sure you've thought about infections, make sure you've thought about malignancy, drugs, and obviously other inflammatory causes as well.
Of course. And I think if I'm seeing such a patient, my primarily focus would be to rule out infective cause and the malignancy. And then later on, I will move on to rule out other autoimmune conditions. Because if the patient is suffering primarily from infection and we misinterpret that and we treat them for suspected vasculitis, they can in turn deteriorate quite quickly.
So that's the crucial one to make sure you've gotten right. Make sure you're happy that there's not an infection going on.
Exactly.
Well, with such a broad list of differentials, there's obviously a huge number of potential investigations you could look into. But I think just for this podcast, what are the investigations that you're going to do to pin down the ANCA positive vasculitis diagnosis?
So from the ANCA positive vasculitis diagnosis point of view, you can send off, when you assess such a patient, you can send off the routine bloods, primarily looking at serum creatinine. If there's renal involvement, if the creatinine is rising, you may be looking for leukocytosis, thrombocytosis, and similarly normochromic anemia. Inflammatory markers such as ESR, CRP would be elevated or could be elevated. but as we understand, they've got poor specificity for vasculitis. The other relevant investigations from the autoimmune panel could include ANA, anti-GBM, complement, cryoglobulins, viral screen, TB, blood cultures, and obviously ANCA itself. The other important bit to always remember is that always urine dip these patients and send off it for further analysis, because that can give you an idea how much kidney involvement there is. And if you would start to think if there's urine involvement, then the treatment would be different. From the imaging point of view, although as a first line, most of these patients, they will have chest X-ray, but it's important to note that oftentimes the pulmonary lesions in these patients, they are often missed on the chest X-ray. So it's good to get a CT chest. And then depending on the patient's symptoms, if they have sinus involvement, orbital involvement, or neck involvement, I may consider about CT head, neck, or these CT head sinuses. The other investigation to consider, if patient particularly have got sensory-motor involvement, you can consider EMG or nerve conduction studies. And some of the other investigations, bronchoscopy in specific cases, biopsy, particularly if you think you've got tissue which you can take for biopsy, it should be done. Although in many cases we can make the diagnosis in the clinical presentation and presence of the antibodies, but importance should be given for a tissue diagnosis.
So like you say, those are the ones that you're going to need to, I guess, establish your diagnosis, rule out some important differentials, and then target down exactly where the vasculitis is affecting so that you can target your treatment accordingly. And what sort of, so say you've got back your ANCA and you've got a positive either PO3 or MPO, but like a strongly positive one, raised inflammatory markers, and you're confident you've ruled out an infection. What sort of treatment are you looking at starting? What helps you decide?
So treatment would very much depend on the disease severity. So we can categorize the disease either non-severe or severe disease, which it would include organ-threatening or life-threatening. So if you decide the patient has a non-severe disease, then you can start the induction regimen based on the use of corticosteroids and a use of second immunosuppressant, which could be mycophenolate, methotrexate, azathioprine. Now, if I talk about severe disease or this organ-threatening or life-threatening condition, then we will have to employ high-dose steroids. Usually, it's given IV methylpred for over 3 to 5 days with the option of using either cyclophosphamide or rituximab. Now, here I would like to talk about rituximab itself as well. Rituximab is a CD20 monoclonal antibody, which targets the CD20 antigen on the surface of B cells. You may remember that we briefly talked about how ANCA is produced from the circulating B cells. So although rituximab, it clears the B cells, it does not affect the plasma cells and it does not clear the antibodies. So after the initial single course of rituximab, you may not notice any change in the serum level of immunoglobulin. So you will monitor your patient, there will be a bit of time when the levels of the antibodies start to go down. That's the reason.
Perfect. So you've gone through, I guess, the importance of classifying the severity of the disease, using that to decide which treatment route to go down. And also it's good, like you said, you've talked about rituximab and related it back to that pathophysiology about making sure we're knocking down the B cells to stop the ANCA production. If we're struggling with those initial therapies and that the patient's disease isn't being well controlled, what other kinds of therapies have we got that we can give patients?
If you're finding it difficult that the patient is not responding to the initial treatment, you can also use IVIGs in refractory diseases and see how those patients, they respond. In addition to this, I would like to talk about some newer therapies as well, which are now available. Along with the ANCA production, there is also complement activation. So there's a newer drug called avacopan, which is complement C5a receptor antagonist. And its efficacy is almost comparable to prednisolone. It can be used as an adjunctive therapy, primarily in severe or organ-threatening disease. And the other beneficial effect of using avacopan is that it's a steroid-sparing disease. So the steroids can be weaned off quicker. And then finally, then you need to start thinking about maintenance therapy. For maintenance, we can use drugs, as previously mentioned, methotrexate, mycophenolate, or azathioprine. an optimal duration of maintenance therapy could be around 2 years after remission. And one thing I would like to highlight is that although ANCA levels are associated, particularly if it's strongly positive, points you towards the diagnosis of ANCA-associated vasculitis, but at the same time, they are not very good prognostic factors to look at the disease activity. For example, in lupus, we look at complement levels and DSDN. We cannot do the same thing with the ANCA levels in these diseases.
Right. Oh, that's very interesting. I didn't realize that the ANCA is essentially primarily diagnostic, and then after that, the use will, well, there won't be really much use, I guess, in retesting the ANCA once you've got a diagnosis. It's not going to give you any more information.
And I'm not going to lie, we often do it. Sometimes it can be useful, but you cannot completely rely on it.
You factor it into the whole picture.
Yeah, you factor into the whole picture.
Brilliant. So I guess thank you very much for going through essentially everything we hopefully need to know about ANCA-positive vasculitis. Is there anything sort of from your entire talk there, any particular key points that you really want people to hold on to, things that you know, your take-home messages, if you like, about ANCA-positive vasculitis?
So my take-home message would be that ANCA-positive vasculitis, or GPA or MPA, it's a rare autoimmune disease, primarily affects respiratory and the kidney. So it's important that these patients are diagnosed early, and the timely treatment is crucial to improve the quality of life and having a good long-term outcome for these patients. A good, thorough history, taking a physical investigation and ordering the relevant investigation can make a huge difference in managing these patients. And involvement of a specialist as soon as you can would be crucial here, because nobody expects you to make the diagnosis. But it's important that you're thinking on the correct path,
so that you can get those initial tests sent off.
Exactly.
Well, that's excellent, Harris. Thank you so much for coming on and for giving us the benefit of your vasculitis wisdom there.
Thank you very much, Tom.
So the last thing, I guess, for me to say is make sure you've checked out the MRCP questions of the week that will be shared on the Instagram and the Twitter and the Facebook page, and make sure you're listening for the episode next week as well. Thank you very much. Bye.